Hello and welcome to the opening arguments live Q&A 35 on time. God, this couldn't be better. How's it going, Andrew?
Well, I always say fantastic, but tonight a little bit of extra fantastic due to your hard work in making all the tech stuff not suck.
Yeah, I think I finally figured it out for the most part. You know, nothing's perfect, but I've at least got this setup figured out. I'm excited to answer some questions. Yeah, I don't know if you want to, you know, we're getting a lot of activity on the group about the last episode and the Kenosha stuff. I don't know. Are you feeling like addressing that at all? Cause I mean, I could say a word about it, but I don't know if you want to save it for Thursday.
Go right ahead.
Well, I
think we'll have no shortage of stuff to cover on Thursday based on
that's
today.
That's true. So. Yeah. I don't know. There's so much. It may be something that, you know, a fraction of, unfortunately, only a fraction of the listeners end up seeing the Q&A, even though it's like one of my favorite things we do. So, you know, on one hand, maybe we should do it for the main show, but I was the one who named the episode in case anybody wants to get mad at someone. It's me. I named it the Kenosha Terrace.
I endorse that name.
Yeah.
I
wasn't sure, but
state lines to sow terror.
Like, yeah. Well, that's the thing. I think people saw it and were like, hey, you know, this wasn't a guy with a manifesto who went out there, you know, to kill people. And so they're like, is it, you know, so naturally it doesn't fit what we've seen from these, you know, right-wing terrorists, which, yeah, fair enough. It does seem as though he didn't try to go out there specifically to, you know, to just go shoot people, but he went out there to shoot people. You know, it's a fine distinction, I guess. He wasn't like live streaming a massacre, but at the same time, when you cross state lines with an assault weapon to protect white people's property that's not yours, you know, against Black Lives Matter protesters, there's a real message there that you're, and something you're a part of.
Also, I want to throw in this because I haven't seen anyone in our community making this mistake, but I have seen folks engaging with people who have made the argument of, well, you know, once somebody tries to tackle him, and look, let me be super clear about this, right? When you begin to commit a violent felony, you don't get to call time out in the middle and go on base and then claim self-defense, right? Like, if I stick up the 7-Eleven and the guy behind the counter pulls out a gun on me, like, I don't get to shoot him in self-defense, right?
Yeah.
I'm the aggressor. I committed the felony. It's actually, we've talked about this. It's one of sort of the classic crim law questions, right? Like, you and I together hold up a 7-Eleven, both go in, it goes terribly wrong, and the cashier shoots you. I'm guilty of felony murder, right? I committed the felony, you got killed. There's no like, well, you know, I just had to defend myself from.
Although at the same time, I want to run this by you because I've seen a lot of people everywhere, not just in our group, but in every interaction that I've seen on this, saying, oh, he was committing a crime, so therefore no self-defense. And yeah. I think maybe it's got to be a little more specific than that, right? I mean, it's not like if he had, you know, a parking ticket that he hadn't paid, then all of a sudden he can't claim self-defense. Or if, you know, there must be some distinction there, or some reasonable standard of like, okay, yes, he was, you know, committing a crime by taking a gun across underage, across state lines, all that stuff. But like, what if somebody had literally just come up behind him and just like hit him with a, you know, a bottle? Or hypothetically, this isn't what happened. Yeah. But I'm just saying, like, the fact that he was already breaking law doesn't magically mean he could never do self-defense, does it?
Yeah, no, that's so yes and no, right? The question is, Wisconsin has particular statutes that sit on top of common law affirmative defenses, right? So what we talked about on the show is how Wisconsin handles what is clear to me from the fact pattern that he's going to argue, which is unreasonable but validly held self-defense, right? I thought this was necessary in order to avoid a felony, you know, somebody else committing a felony. Even though that belief is objectively unreasonable. So, you know, that's what you would do is you would calibrate the particular facts of the situation to the specific statutory delineation that Wisconsin has done. And again, they differentiate between reasonable and unreasonable uses of force, right, to defend yourself or others.
Okay.
And that supplements, you know, the common law rules. So,
well, plenty more to talk about on Thursday, I'm sure, with that. But we should get to the questions.
Michael, I just wanted Flynn to, news today. Our amicus is back on.
Yeah. Okay. But we, as always, need to go to the patreon.com/law post where we invite people to ask questions for these Q&A. And as always, it is Teresa Gomez, T. Gomes, who's got the first question. That's right. I can pan over to it here with my fancy technology. She asks, if you get convicted of legal malpractice, can that be enough to disbar someone? Are legal malpractice cases common or effective?
Great, surprisingly, on you know, topical question, but thank you, Teresa. Here's what I would say. First, legal malpractice claim, bar complaints alleging legal malpractice are, I don't know how to describe how common they are. I will tell you, in Maryland, as somebody who has had friends sit on the bar advisory committee, right? Like, I'm on the board of directors for the Federal Bar Association in Maryland, and like, one of the things we do is staff the bar grievance committee, you know, that serves as the intake filter. So I could probably get actual numbers. Maryland will disbar somewhere on the order of the close order of 5 to 10 people per year. And as I've said on the show, almost all of that, are cases involving financial fraud.
Yeah.
Right. And what usually, if you
say are convicted or charged, I don't know if they're convicted of pointing guns recklessly at protesters in St. Louis or whatever that was.
That absolutely violates the model rules of professional conduct, right? Like our rules, I can't cite you chapter and verse here, but our rules have catch-all provisions, right? And so as part of those catch-all provisions, it will say like conduct unbecoming to an officer of the court, right? And shooting it, you know, they didn't shoot. Waving your guns at peaceful protesters who are walking by your property in violation of the law. Like that absolutely is the kind of thing that you ought to be filing a bar complaint against these folks if you live in Wisconsin. Sorry, they weren't from Wisconsin. They were from St. Louis. So if you're in Missouri, but again, it will not be taken seriously unless you were a client or potential client, right? Mm. So put all that together. Look, you pretty much get disbarred for financial improprieties, but financial improprieties often accompany legal incompetence, right? Like that is, I pay my lawyer. My lawyer lies about missing the court date. I ask, oh, why did I default on this? They make something up and they try not to give back my money. Because, you know, if you're the kind of lawyer that misses court dates, like you probably can't afford to give back the money, right? So they tend to go hand in glove. But I will say that like, disbarment is usually when the offense is financial in nature and or repeated offenders, right? Like if you've been censured, disciplined, suspended from the practice of law already for a year, like sometimes they will come back and say, all right, like that's enough. Now that's going to segue into T. Gomes's next question, which is, well, then what the hell is with Larry Klayman? I don't have an answer for that
one. Yeah.
I just don't know.
You know, several dozen personal appearance comments in the chat to reply to. Someone said, okay, look, I get that I sound like Dave Rubin, and I hate that I do, but sometimes even I hear it when I'm editing.
You sound like Norm McDonald.
I don't look like Dave Rubin. Who is? Somebody said I look like Dave Rubin. Fuck off. No. I might sound like him. I don't look like, come on. And then someone commented on my beard. Yeah, I it's been too long. It is hot in California. Plus just the sheer amount of smoke that must be just
embedded. Yeah.
Yeah. Just,
I'm absorbed. Thinking about going clean.
No, don't everybody stop this man from doing that.
Here's the thing.
No, I don't want to hear it.
You can see it in the feed. I trimmed down the beard right before coming on the air, right? Because it was definitely getting a little woolly.
It looks better. Remember when Andrew didn't have a beard and it sucked?
It looks so gray there. I feel like I look so fucking old, man.
It's anyway. Just that people like it. I see all the commercials whether you comb the dark cut dye.
Oh, yeah, a little touch of gray.
You want
there?
The all touch right. of gray. I think that's the ideal look.
Okay. I'll go for touch of gray. Oh,
man.
It looked less gray before I buzzed it down, but you know.
Yeah, actually, I feel like that happens to me too. It looks lighter when it's just stubble. So So I'm getting there. I've got gray coming. It's coming. All right.
Keep podcasting. Yeah. You'll go there.
In this day and age, let's go to another question. Crucifixion mm-hmm. is faithful execution asks, nice. What's the strangest fact pattern you've ever personally had in a case? Look, it's got a lot of heart. So I wanted to, I think we've had questions like this before, but what comes to mind? Strange fact pattern.
So a couple of things. I have one right now that, I can't talk about, where, I've actually gotten sanctions against opposing counsel. This is going to be a great story once this, dispute has been resolved, if I can talk about it, but I can't right now.
Well, how about this? Could we just use this question as an opportunity to answer what has been a question people have been asking in some patron or whatever, what is the Derek Jeter gift basket story? How about you tell that? I thought Tagomes was going to do it, but maybe she didn't catch that one.
I don't know how this got associated with me, but apparently, well, I know how it got associated with me.
You look like a lot like him, so
right. Derek Jeter, again, I should mention this is 100% rumor and hearsay. It passes the New York Times v. Sullivan, and Derek Jeter watching in the chat is welcome to send me a cease and desist, and I'll correct the record.
Can you send an autographed baseball with that cease and desist?
Yeah, you can have it.
eBay, I meant, but yeah. Well, it helped pay our legal bills.
he was well known for hooking up with women on the road and leaving, and would leave behind gift baskets with like autographed baseballs in it and stuff like that. It's just weird. It's just a little weird. Yeah. So that's it. Like, I don't know why this got, you know,
what does that have to do with you?
Built up with such a thing, but
did you sleep with him and get a little, get baskets? Is that why?
You know, there is that story of, I think it's Penn Jillette that tells it, you know, talking about like, you know, if he ever had the opportunity to, he started telling the story, you know, obviously in the waning years of the Clinton administration, but he was like, yeah, if you ever had the opportunity to perform oral sex on the president, obviously you say yes, right? Like
he said he would do it too.
The story that you have to tell, like why, like when are you ever going to get that opportunity again? And I think, you know, that's probably good advice.
If I know women, they would love a gift basket. I'm sure they'd feel really, really special in that scenario. Like, yeah, anyway, general contact unit problem child asks, the other day, Andrew said, if someone under 35 ran and won the presidency, the Supreme Court would probably just say, yeah, it's unconstitutional, but it's a non-justiciable political question. Would they likely say the same thing if someone who's already been president twice tried to run and win a third term? Apropos of nothing.
So, I was probably a little too cavalier in saying, you know, that it would definitely be non-justiciable. But I think what I mean is that I would calibrate the relief that the Supreme Court could award, and how easy it would be to solve the problem.
I think the Supreme Court should say, say you're elected and you're 33, 34. Your mom should be president for that year until you're of age.
You'll be president regent.
Yeah, or next, legal guardian.
When you have a queen regent because the king is not old enough. But that's the thing, right? Is that the difference between the two scenarios is the president declares, right? A two-term Barack Obama declares in 2016, you know, files the paperwork to run again. Immediately, somebody sues for an injunction to block him from doing that. That's the kind of relief that the Supreme Court could award. But, like, it's July, right? You've gone all the way to a contested convention, and the Democrats have nominated AOC, and she's won 30 primaries. Like, that's a very different set of relief for the Supreme Court to come in and be like, nope, we're going to toss out, like, all of the primaries that she won and, you know, make Joe Biden the candidate instead. So that's the difference. I mean, again, I wouldn't say that I'm 100% confident that the Supreme Court would definitely not touch it, particularly if it was early enough. But, you know, replace that. The more attenuated the question becomes, the more political the relief is, the more comfortable I feel saying that the Supreme Court would not touch it. So,
yeah, I'm still confused. I don't really get what's justiciable and what isn't. I feel like
I don't think the Supreme Court does.
Right? Yeah, I mean, but says in the Constitution you can't or can do a thing, and so somebody violates that, and then the Supreme Court should be like, you violated that. I don't get...
But so let me give you a super easy example, okay, right?
Here we go.
Suppose Elizabeth Warren won a super majority of the primary votes, but then we discovered that, like, she, you know, failed to fill out, like, and some mandatory, like, election law is super clear. I don't know. She just spaced. She was missing that day from, you know, candidate school. And she failed to file, like, a particular piece of paperwork, right? Do you really think, and then Joe Biden files a lawsuit that goes to the Supreme Court that says, I want an injunction declaring that me as the second place candidate.
I think
is
a
the
reasonable
Democratic
person
nominee.
Can be like, yeah. All right, go fill out that paper and turn it in now or something. Whereas if you're just blatantly
violating. But
that's
not what the law says. But that's not what the law says, right? I mean,
what
does
the law
say? You see
what
I'm doing,
say?
Right?
Yeah, I don't
Suppose the law says you must file the piece of paper by January 1, 2020, and nobody notices that she hasn't filed it until July.
Does the law say what's supposed to happen if you don't, or what?
And suppose the law says it makes you ineligible as a candidate, right? Like, it still, I think in that area, the Supreme Court would say, like, no, man, like, we're going to have a riot in the streets if the Supreme Court says that the democratically elected Democratic candidate for presidency is not eligible to run. That's the way I think about these political questions. Yeah.
I mean, so that's still like a law. It's not like the Constitution says, I don't know what, like if somebody tries to quarter a soldier in my home and then I throw it to the Supreme Court, it's pretty straightforward. And then they're like, sorry, I can't justice that. I don't know. We don't want to go in your, I don't get it. Like what? I don't understand. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm saying I don't get the distinction.
I think it is fair to say that the Supreme Court's justiciability doctrine cases are not.
They leave something to be desired.
Yeah.
They leave this reviewer cold. Okay. Let's go to another question here. Here's a quick one. Steven Wetzel asks, is don't take legal advice from a podcast itself legal advice? Should we take it? It's got a lot of hearts, so why don't you address that one?
No, that is like the law is actually pretty good in stopping these kinds of infinite regress cases, right? So, for example, the first tax case I ever I'm going to try and turn this into a real question as best as I can. So when I took tax law in law school. One of the very first cases we talked about was the definition of taxable income, right? And basically, taxable income is everything that your employer gives you, right? And so there was a case early on, right after, I guess it's the 18th Amendment, right after income tax was a thing, in which an employer agreed to pay his employees' income taxes, right? Huh. And so then the question was, could you tax him on that, right? And
yeah,
and the answer, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the answer was yes. Right. Like, and, yeah. And what you did is you just did the sum of a convergent series.
I was going to say, you have to do an infinite right sum. <Yeah. laughs>
So there you go. I feel really good. Right. That, the purpose,
it is crazy that you have to do higher level, like you have to do calculus in order to get that answer. Like, isn't that funny? It's a tax. I love that. Yeah. Also, somebody in the chat said, and I will probably not properly remember what this was, but Shane Donahoe says, Aussie conservatives, wait, dual UK citizen doesn't count. Yeah, I remember, who did I have? Jake, I think probably Jake on my show that I have from time to time, Jake Farwharton. And that was the whole Jake. Thing in Australia, right? Because there was some law that was like, you can't, I don't know, be a something, a representative or in Congress or whatever it was, if you're a dual citizen. You know, like mm-hmm. Australia and anybody, any other country. And it turned out like a bunch of people were, including the conservatives who brought that, or if I'm using the proper party term, I don't remember. But it ended up being a really, really double-edged sword for them. And they actually did commit to like trying to get rid of everybody. I'm pretty sure, you know, like they expelled people or they found a way to, you know, renounce their dual citizenship. So anyway, just different story over there.
A la Ted Cruz.
Yeah. They did their Supreme Court wasn't like, nah, it's okay. You know, that's my bad version of that. I it's been a, I don't know, year since somebody told me that, and it's another country and we have enough to keep track of in this country, but it was something like that. I can't remember. Anyway.
I loved it when we had Emma McClure on to talk Brexit, and she just sort of casually threw out like, well, you know, like whatever the Supreme Court says about the law, like that's what the law becomes, right? Like there's no, because it, you know, you think of it as it's a parliamentary democracy, but like, you know, they have, and she was like, no, like. What the Supreme Court says, the law, like that's it. There's no like I appeal to the Queen or, you know, to a document or whatever. It was blew my mind. So anyway,
yeah. Well, wait. How is that? I get that they don't have the Constitution, but it's still even here. What the Supreme Court says, the Constitution says, is the end of the story, isn't it?
Well, like, but for example, you could not. Every once in a while, I'll see someone say. You know, you should sue to argue that the Second Amendment is unconstitutional, right? And I get what they mean by that, but like that is a, you know, definitionally a nonsense lawsuit, right?
Yeah.
Like something in the Constitution can't be unconstitutional, no matter how horrible it is. And it seems like in Britain, like, they're free to say like, oh yeah, no, that right. That would be a terrible idea. Like we're definitely not going to have one of those. So.
And thanks Shane for that. So they mostly resigned, the updated, they mostly resigned. They canceled their other citizenship and either got reappointed or won the election. Yeah. But they, I mean, but they did the have Cruz. To like do all that. It wasn't their Supreme Court, which I can only assume is a kangaroo, a snake and a poisonous spider. We're like, no, you're sorry. You're out.
a poisonous spider the size of your torso.
Yeah. So, yeah. All right. Here we go. Ben Ghazi in the buttery mails.
In the buttery mails.
Maybe
love that,
this has been asked before. Oh, did I interrupt you? You finished that other question, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe this has been asked before, maybe not, but here's what I want to know. At the end of the show, you always thank a bunch of awesome folks, including a bunch of totally unrelated Smiths, for helping research, moderation, wiki editing, etc. If those folks don't mind you sharing, could you tell us a little bit more about who they are and what they do? And thank you to all of you who help keep things going behind the scenes. Oh, what a great question. And that had 25 hearts. So a lot of people want to know who to thank here. And
that
why.
Is fantastic. So we have like one of the things I love the most about this show is that we have such a great community of people who have supported the show whom we've been able to hire, and also people who have volunteered. Right. So. Let's go through the list. First, let's start talking about the Smiths, right? So, we've talked. Yeah. Well, we've talked about the thanks to you in that. And this is, related to a question someone asked a couple of Q&As ago. But the reason we say that the theme music is, by you and used with permission is because you own the opening arguments theme music as Thomas Smith and not Opening Arguments Media LLC. And I thought that that was important, right?
Like, yeah, no, that was a great question. When that was first brought up, I too was confused. But you said, if I correct me if I'm wrong, that if we didn't say that, then Opening Arguments would just like own that song, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Then let's see. I think we give a shout out to Lydia, your wife, who does.
Well, she's doing the shout outs now. I don't know if you've listened to the new outro, but she's doing all of it.
I have.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm just thinking went on the list of Smiths.
Sure.
Deborah Smith, whom you will see active, in the Facebook community, and in the atheist community generally. She does a tremendous amount of work in sending me very, very particular stories right throughout the week. I'm saying this on here. I've got it covered. You don't have to send me stories. You will not make it onto the shout out list. I've got more stuff that I can read that I can know how.
Yeah.
There is Ashley Smith. Ashley Smith is my assistant. She supports Opening Arguments. She also supports the law firm. If you ever call the firm with a business matter, you will talk to Ashley, who is delightful and wonderful. And without Ashley, I would never make an appointment, right? Like, people be like, hey, let's talk on Wednesday. I'd be like, sure, cool, that's great. And then I would never talk to them again.
That's what I currently do. So maybe I guess I need an Ashley.
Yeah, you do. Like she's crucial to the operation of the firm. Let's see. What else? Ashley also maintains she maintains the social media, right? So most you can sometimes tell on the Opening Arguments Twitter account, like when I'm saying something directly. But a lot of like retweets, and engagement like that, Ashley monitors that cause you know, I just don't have the time to do that. And she helps, I will say to her, like I said earlier today, I'm like, holy shit, go get me the Flynn order. Right. And she's great in terms of, being able to track down stuff like that. Who else helps, in our chat? And we have a shout out to, Morgan Stringer. Morgan, as many of you know, is an associate at my law firm, and is, fantastic. And I can't say enough, great things about her work in terms of really allowing the firm to do stuff that we couldn't do if it was just me. Right. Who else? We also give shout outs to the people who volunteer in various capacities, including the fabulous Teresa Gomez, who always first on the questions here, runs the OA Wiki, and runs our live shows. And Teresa's amazing. Who else is on there? We also give a shout out to the moderators in the OA Facebook group, which thank God, because I don't want to have to do that. That includes Alicia Cook and a bunch of the people we've already mentioned, and also Emily Waters. And I think that is the extended Opening Arguments family. Thomas, have I left anybody out?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, I don't think so. I was busy thinking about someone was asking about Reddit. I don't know if it's a joke, Ryan asking, whatever Andrew Torres Reddit user actually Andrew Torres?
That was me.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I didn't. This is news to me. I thought you didn't have Reddit. So I just was worried that we had an imposter in our midst. But okay. No, I'm on there too. I've also... I haven't gone on the OA one in a while, but I've messaged or I posted in there at some point.
Yeah, and I think we saw Liz Weeks in the chat. Liz runs the Change My View subreddit, which is like super huge, and I know she did some work on getting our Reddit up. So shout out to her too.
Yeah, people are talking about Brian. We, of course, love Brian forever, but Brian stepped back from editing. I've been editing the last 2 months. I really, really love Brian, and he's got his hands full with kids and homeschooling in the time of COVID. So that's why we didn't mention Brian, but we forever in our hearts, we love Brian. And I wish we were still doing live shows so we could hang out again.
Yeah, no, we love Brian. And also, God, I feel super bad about this. I blame the alcohol and doing it off the top of my head. Heather Loveridge, our transcriptionist. Ooh. So that Heather is the person who made me this lovely, precious little cinnamon bun glass. I know she made one for you too, Thomas. Not a precious little cinnamon bun because you're not. But
oh, yeah.
No. Yeah. She's amazing. Really does a fantastic job on the transcripts, where, you know, I feel like we're probably not using those as effectively. Like, there's so much I want to do mm-hmm. with the OA content, but, you know, we're running in place because there's just so much going on. But
yeah, I'm barely keeping up with just the world. It's tough. Yeah. All right. We'll go to, that was a great question. And I'm glad we got a chance to give shout outs. And if anybody remembers anybody we missed, let us know, but it's hard off the top of our heads with the full IPA I've just had, which, you know, IPAs are strong nowadays.
They're like 8% sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Gary Myers asks, can you plead the fifth in a federal case in which you have been given immunity by claiming that you could be incriminating yourself in a state level case? Ooh, interesting. Ooh,
that's a really great question. Yeah. And Gary, I have to tell you, I think the answer to that would be that you could. I would say this is 100% speculation, right? So here are the things that I'm thinking about, right? The first is, when I have seen that technique used, right? And the technique is to immunize a potential witness, potentially hostile, so that you can compel their testimony. Typically, the thing that they're worried about is only either a state or federal crime, right? So for example, like, you know, if I've murdered somebody in my basement, and as far as you know, I haven't, and I'm asked to testify, like, what did I do Monday night? I say, plead the fifth.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Right. I elect not to testify on the grounds that anything I say may tend to incriminate myself. And then, the prosecutor says, we're going to immunize you for the murder that occurred in your basement. And I say, oh, well, yeah, well, what I did was I stabbed this guy in the neck in my, right. And that's because that can only be brought as a state law crime. Mm-hmm. So
state law?
Yeah. Murder is a state
law. Yeah. That's – you're right. Yeah. Sorry. Yep. My fault.
So here's the thing. If in a situation where a crime could be brought in either jurisdiction, I would think that the law would be somewhat analogous to the law of double jeopardy, which is actually parsed, like, as you know, from – both
from a bar question that I'm going to get wrong soon. Yeah. Yeah, right. Coming to a bar
that examining that's parsed like really, really thinly, right? Like,
yeah.
You can face a second prosecution from a second sovereign in most cases, you know, in most jurisdictions that have not specifically abolished the dual sovereigns doctrine. So, all that's a way of saying, I think it's kind of a corner case. And the reason it's a corner case is because a state prosecutor can't immunize you from federal crimes, right? They can only immunize you from state crimes. So
could you do like some in camera or something where like you're admitting to crimes, but only, you know, in the forum that you know what I mean? Like, is there some way to, is sealed testimony something there? Or if you, like, let's say you didn't do this and you were unbeknownst to you because you're not don't have a good lawyer or whatever. You're like, oh, yeah, I can admit to that because you've given me immunity. What's the mechanism for the state or whatever, the federal charge coming about? Is it like, oh, we saw your testimony and now we're charging you with this crime?
And that gets into, I mean, we should do, we've talked about it before, and I don't
eminent domain. Do, here we go.
Yeah. I don't want to do it off the cuff because the difference between use immunity, transactional immunity, like it is, we could delve into the specifics on that.
Okay.
And I don't want to get it wrong. So I'm going to defer.
On this topic though, did you see that? I thought New York was like trying to get rid of the thing where, you know, the double, yeah. We talked about this before, right?
The dual sovereigns doctrine.
Yeah. Yeah. So did they do that? Is that another topic we need to talk about on the show?
I think that when last I checked, that was pending in like February. I would think that it,
oh, I thought it was passed, like a month ago.
Yeah. And well, you know, could have passed a month.
We're in August now somehow. No, we're in September.
No,
in like
this
a day.
Yeah, September yeah. in 4 hours.
Geez. Yep. Crazy. Where are we? Who am I? Okay. Next question,
am,
I think.
Why am I here?
Yeah. That was a great question though, Gary. Nice one. Mm-hmm. Jesse Tim, what is the legal doomsday scenario that would have to play out for a total fascist takeover? Wait, that already happened. Am I in, now what timeline am I in? Oh, they would have to total fascist takeover of our democracy should 45 win in November. I'm very scared that a GOP victory will spell the end of Western democracy and would like to know if I'm justified in my fears or if I should just calm the fuck down. Well, I don't know about Western democracy. I feel like that's, for us, sure.
So here's, I have a lot of thoughts about this. I think the first answer that I would give is, both, right? Like you should calm the fuck down. But you should also be vigilant about this, right? Like, so let me, for example, like one of the reasons that it's really easy for me to take up the Optimus Prime mantle, right? Is
you love the Transformers.
I love the Transformers. but also that like, I look at our story and the news coverage of the post office, right? And like that, I see that did good, right? Like, look, we shouldn't have to be fighting this, right? It is crazy and preposterous and stupid that we have a president who says out loud, yeah, I want to sabotage the post office so that we can't count mail in voting, right? Like, so those are all the reasons why you should be justified in your fears. But the fact that we have recourse, the fact that that's still not normal, right, is why you should calm the fuck down, right? And I would say this. I think we are so far. The things that scare me the most about what Trump is doing and that would scare me the most from 4 more years of Trump are the erosion of institutions, right? Like, is that 8 years later, you will have an entire generation of like 20-year-olds who have never known what it's like, you know, politically to live in a country in which the president cares about the law, right? Like that's, and it's that kind of slow erosion over time that is the most terrifying to me. And the flip side of that is, right, if I'm worried about, so for example, right, like Donald Trump will get at least 2 more and possibly 4 more Supreme Court appointments if he's reelected, right? And I just want you to think about like what our judiciary would look like with 6 Trump appointees on the Supreme Court, right?
Like, yeah, I'm very worried about that.
And you should be, right? Yeah. So that's where you should be justified in your fears. But think about what that means underneath of it, right? For the Supreme Court to mean something means that there is not a fascist takeover of democracy such that institutions don't matter, right? So that's... I feel like it's kind of the same. It's adjacent to the like, what if Donald Trump refuses to leave the White House after he loses in January of 2021? And the answer is that like guys with guns are going to march his fat orange ass out of there, right? Like, and to believe that they won't means you have to think that the Secret Service, the police, and the military all back Donald Trump over the idea of America. And I just don't think we're there. So
yeah, I don't think we're quite there. But again, this is a question about with 4 more years of Trump, you know, that will mean that the party and candidate one that put up a platform that just says, whatever this guy says, we don't really, we're not going to do the work of like writing out a platform that sounds hard. So just whatever Trump says, if that's not some level of fascism, I don't know what is.
That's why I said what I did at the outset, right? Like it's, I do not want to say, I'm thinking of the, like, you know, meme of the little dog in the burning house with everything is fine, right? Like, yeah, I'm not trying to tell you everything is fine. Slight digression, but I was thinking about this because, it's going on, right? Debate season is back up again. My son actually came down the stairs in the middle of the Q&A. The debate topic for September, October is, in a democracy, voting ought to be compulsory, right? And Alex's case is entirely based around the idea that right-wing populism is on the rise in the US and around the world. And one of the primary drivers of right-wing populism is voter suppression, right? Saying, hey, we're going to build the wall. We're going to like enact strict voter ID laws. We're going to keep like those people from being a part of the process. And so one of the reasons to have universal voting in the United States is as a bulwark against that kind of fascism. So I say that because because his debate case is based on academic literature and research, and like academics are saying fascism is on the rise in the United States and around the world, right? Like this is a studied phenomenon. And so, you know, it's both terrifying and hopeful at the same time. So.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, no, I think we should have universal vote. Everybody should have to vote. I've said that for years. It's so funny. Yep. The things we do to like, people get up in arms over that. I'm like, why would that be so bad? It's not, you can vote nobody. Like, leave that as an option. Yep. You know, like, but you got to fill out a stupid form. There's a lot of things we have to do. You have to file, you know, do your taxes. You have to do, like, it's not the end of the world. It sucks.
Well, and as if preparing for the debate, Thomas Dougherty in the question says, in the chat says, it's an extra chance to punish people. You'd think conservatives would be all over that. And, yeah. And I'm not kidding. That is so part of the negative arguments are, right? How are you going to enforce this? Oh, you're going to fine people? Well, you know, guess who that falls most harsh on? You know?
And yeah.
So getting into the weeds, you guys don't care about that. I might do a show because I've read so much literature on compulsory voting, but.
I want compulsory voting, so I would love that show. Okay, let's go to another question here. Actually, how far are we? Should we start going to the bottom? Maybe we'll go to the bottom of the question thread here and see what we have.
Maybe the middle?
Well, what sense does that make? I like to go to the ones that were just asked hours ago, okay. You know? I think I was around the middle. Oh, okay. I should have been vetting this while you were answering, though.
Yeah,
let's
I know.
See. I get so forever. Just enraptured with what you're saying is the problem. Here, how about we get a one for fun right now, and that'll buy me some time. Brian Mendel asks, if I'm out walking my dog and she does her business in someone's yard, am I still obligated to clean up after her if the homeowner has a Devin Nunes 2020 sign in their yard? You answer that while I look for another question.
Yes, I can. Boy, you know, Devin Nunes is really, really pushing it. No, I already have Eli as a client, so I'm gonna go with follow the law. But I will point out there are two ways to look at the penalty. Right, that the penalty for failure to clean up dog doo from someone's yard is going to be a fine. And so you can either look at that as a punishment, or you can look at that as the price of admission to leave dog poop in Devin Nunes's yard. So I can't stop you from whatever outlook you'd like to have.
All right. Thanks for buying me some time. We got an interesting one here. Peter Gertis asks, can Trump's Secret Service detail be subpoenaed for evidence of his crimes. On a more crazy note, if they overhear Trump planning to commit some obvious crime, for example, put people with COVID in the room with Biden to get him sick, are they supposed to act? I vaguely remember when they were guarding Chelsea at Stanford, there was discussion of how they wouldn't rat about illegal drug use. Yeah, interesting question. I can't remember if we've ever tackled that.
We have not, and I don't know, but let me give you my best guess on that. And that is, I'm going to do this by analogy to attorney-client privilege, right? And one of the things that, you know, as a function of attorney-client privilege is that, that there are constraints, right? Like just having a lawyer in the room doesn't make it a privileged communication. You have to be asking the lawyer for legal advice or to do a law thing. And they have to be rendering that legal advice or doing the law thing. They can't be helping you commit a crime. They can't be doing a non-law thing, right? Like when I have business meetings with Puzzle and a Thunderstorm, like those meetings are not attorney-client privilege unless I'm rendering advice on, you know, potential libel suits, which, to be honest, I usually am. Attorney-client privilege is broken if there's a third party in the room. But attorney-client privilege is not broken when the party's agents come into the room, right? So classic example, right? CEO, she's in the room with her lawyer and the CEO's secretary comes in, you know, personal assistant, whatever. That doesn't break the privilege, right? It's assumed to extend to your agents. And I have to think, I've never seen any litigation involving the Secret Service. But I would think that the Secret Service would be given the highest level of presumed agency in order to make sure.
I mean,
sure
they're called
they can,
the Secret Service. Yeah. You probably, a lawyer would ask him
they're
a question.
Not called,
like,
they're not called the Public Service.
Look at my name tag. It's a Secret Service. I'm not talking.
I got the little black badge and everything.
Yeah. So. Here's a fun one. Where is it? There it is. Campin Dan asks, Andrew, say there is a thermonuclear holocaust and the survivors are digging through the rubble looking for items to help rebuild society. What one text, law, constitutional amendment, book, etc., do you think would form the best basis for a new legal system and why?
Ooh. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I think they should just find a Transformer toy and then that will, no, that could be your answer.
So here's the, I'm going to give you the answer I would have given you up until 5 years ago, and I think it's probably still the right answer for post-apocalyptic universe, and that would be John Locke's
Ayn Rand's,
Second Treatise.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. No, different. Yeah, yeah. Different podcast. Yeah.
John Locke's Second Treatise of Government. But that being said, right, and it's a super easy answer. It is the foundation for the Constitution. It is the
I just want to give us another shitty U.S. Constitution again. Come on, we've already seen how that works.
It's the single but I mean, again, you know, you're rebuilding from the cockroach times, and and I think it's the most.
Is this a cockroach government or a human government? We do need to know.
But so with all that in mind, let me say that. And I've hinted about this on the show, but I don't think I've ever said it this directly. I am coming to the position where I think that we can say, right, like, look, there are some concepts in Locke that are plainly outdated, right? Like Locke's definition of property is that you mix your labors with that which is unowned and thereby come to own the object, right? And you can kind of imagine, like, the view of Americans and being like, yeah, we love that, right? Like, nobody owns this here. Like, you know, what about those million people? Shut up, right? Like, that they don't count, right? Like, they're not building houses out of these trees, so they don't count, right? So, so there are some things in Locke that are embarrassing relics of the 18th century that we would not want to repeat. And I'm starting to think, and again, this is not exclusively Locke. This is John Stuart Mill in particular later. But I am starting to think that like the marketplace of ideas, man, it just does not work in an age of social media. And the idea that like the best solution to speech is more speech. I've done the pluses and minuses before, and like it's getting harder and harder to answer the argument of like, but what about like 70% of America right now that only get their news from sources that reinforce their beliefs?
On that topic, I've had a depressing thought lately and a confusing thought that I don't know what to do with. I'll just run it by you. If the world, or a substantial part of amount of the world, like millions and millions, if not billions of people, do eventually die as a result of climate change, whatever systems we were doing by definition weren't good then. Like, what if it, like, if that's the thing, you know what I mean? Like, what if it's true that like, no, actually a dictator system, which would have been able to just say, well, I see climate change and we're fixing it. Like, fuck everybody else. I don't care about anything you're doing. That system would have worked out better that if you up the stakes enough to where, cause like you say, when you talk about the, you know, the marketplace of ideas, somehow, I don't know what it is, if it's a technology thing or just wherever we've gotten, enough people are able to confuse everything with fake facts and too, you know, like only like with, you know, with these protests. I know that my right-wing family is only seeing every single night, they're seeing on the news, oh, the fires and looting and riots and fires and looting and riots, and they're seeing it framed that way every night. And honestly, like, as much as I think they're wrong about virtually everything, I don't know that like that I can really blame them if that's what they're seeing every night for thinking, well, I guess these protesters are just out of control. You know, it's like at the, so my thought was like, maybe we aren't good enough at governing ourselves. What is the system that will work? If we all die of fucking climate change, then I don't care that I got a vote. What are the, what good does that do? Oh, I got a say in the matter.
My 30 seconds is, you know, this is sort of the classic like process versus utilitarianism argument, right? Like it is it, at some point, are there consequences so significant that they overwhelm everything? And and I'll throw out like literature to read, like Nick Bostrom, for example, who argues basically that like, we need to be spending all of our resources making sure that like we don't develop killer AI that will exterminate us down on the cellular level.
I don't care about the reason for that,
right, is because he's saying in a utilitarian calculus, if
a
you
tiny
wait,
percent chance, but of just giant consequences.
And it's not, so it's two, this is the second math calculation we've done on this Q&A. This is great. It's not just, right? So the first order math calculation is small probability by huge magnitude. But Bostrom adds a wrinkle to that, and that is infinite series over time, right? That like if future lives, either future lives have positive value or they do not. But even if future lives have an infinitesimal value, they're going to screw up your utilitarian calculus. And Bostrom puts it this way. He says, I want you to imagine three scenarios. Number one, we're fine. Number two, nuclear war that kills 99% of the population. Number three, nanobot micro disassemblers that kill us at the molecular level that kill 100% of the population. And his argument, I mean, just to condense it down, is most people would think that the difference between A and B is the largest, but it's actually the difference between B and C that is the largest in any kind of utilitarian scheme. Because in B, like, you know, like we took on the book question, right? Like you could rebuild future civilization, but like on C, it's it. I mean, that's it. Humanity is 100% extinct. And so it creates these weird, and I'm not saying Bostrom is right. I'm just saying it's an interesting.
Well, also
argument.
I don't, those are some population ethics is a really interesting branch of philosophy that I'm very interested in because I don't think it's straightforward at all. But let's get to another question here. But
I'm putting a plug in for monarchy or something,
dictatorship, one world government.
I wanted to put a plug in for, I think most of the people in the audience are probably aware that you do the show Philosophers in Space with our buddy Aaron Rabinowitz. But if you like these kinds of questions and you hate listening to me dominate conversations.
That's 0% of people.
Listen, if you like these kinds of conversations.
That's why no one listens to Philosophers. No, it's, it has
It's a great show. I listen to it, whenever it comes out. So
nice. You know, thank you for that. I appreciate it. Yeah. I want to get to this Liz Weeks question that has only two hearts.
We love you, Liz Weeks.
I'm going to guess one of them is Liz Weeks, but just because of this. Liz Witnesseth Me Weeks asks, in a contract, thoughts on and or? And then she says, this is a good question, in all caps and a reply. So I guess it wasn't getting enough votes. So thoughts on and or and slash or wording in a contract. Interesting.
I love that. Okay. I think Liz and I are about to be simpatico on this because both of us have day jobs that involve drafting of contracts. The single most important thing in a contract is to preserve the unambiguous intent of the parties in situations where, in the future, one party may have a tremendous financial advantage to argue that it's ambiguous. Right? Like, that's why you do it. And I've talked about this before, but like, I litigated a case for 6.5 years involving one sentence in a contract where the other interpretation was, in my view, preposterous. But all of a sudden, people find preposterous interpretations very plausible when the preposterous interpretation will save them $250 million, right? Like, it's for $250 million, I will believe
you can get really
crazy
dumb
shit. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so for a very, very long time, for all of Western civilization, the way to kind of lock down all of those contingencies was right, the things that we make fun of as 13th century Saxony, like construct, whereas the party of the first part and or the party of the second part hereby in perpetuity throughout the universe, right? Like, and I am a huge fan, and let me be super clear about this, of direct language in contracts, but not like. there is, I'm going to shit on some friends of ours here because they're not listening. There is a podcast, right, that does a totally sarcastic, ending, a disclaimer. And I would advise, and I have in fact advised them that, that's a terrible idea, right? Like, and that's also a trend.
I'm sure I'm walking into something, but who are you talking about? I don't know what that is.
Oh, Cogdis. Right.
They have a fake disclaimer at the end.
They have a, yeah, like this is brought to you by the American Dairy Council. And right. And, oh, and so, huh. And so here's the thing, right? There are also lawyers who, cause they don't have my job. They're trying to be edgy and funny. And so they're drafting like funny or sarcastic disclaimers or contracts. And I think that's terrible, right? Like, because that also maximizes ambiguity, right? Like, and so my answer to Liz Weeks's question is I want to write contracts that minimize ambiguity. I think stilted language like and or is almost never helpful. You will nevertheless find like my contracts, probably like you will find and slash or in some of my contracts, I'm sure, where, you know, you just, I've got 20 plus years of writing like a dumbass. But I do try and write as clearly as possible. And I think that that's how you best serve your clients, by minimizing ambiguity. So we do a super quick lightning round.
Time for one. Oh, we're already in that. So time for one more question. here we go. Steve S. asks, do you think a political realignment is coming anytime soon? What are the best and worst cases or scenarios for us? And unless I'm not understanding what that means, I think we've already had that. We've had white people fully shift over to the Republican Party for the most part in huge numbers, especially white non-educated or whatever the proper term is for that. That's been a huge shift in there. I think the gender breakdown is bigger than it ever has been. The gender gap in party support is bigger than it has been. So we're seeing huge demographic realignments, but is that what he means? What's a political realignment?
I think what he means is, right, do the Republicans fade away and the libertarians take their place? Given institutional issues, that's much more, does the Republican Party in 20
change
years
into something or
resemble like what the libertarians are now? I loved, like, I hadn't thought of answering the question that way, but I love your answer of that just happened.
The 2012 to 2016 had some huge and important shifts. That's demographic shifts. I don't know if that's what, you know, I'm with you in that we'll still have the names Republican and Democrat, for a very long time, for the foreseeable future, I think. But they may, represent different ideas over time to try to, become more popular if ever we get to have other presidents win besides Trump in the future. We'll see.
I feel naive when you look at the Hofeller docs, right, and you see that the Republican Party was had at its core the seeds of white nationalism in the 1990s, because I wouldn't have said that, right? And the evidence is right there to smack you in the face, right? Like, you got a guy who's got a subdirectory, right, with a file that says how to advantage, white people. So my answer to the question, I love the realignments already happened and there's no better illustration of that than the Republican Party not putting out a platform in 2020. We're just whatever Trump wants. Weren't you guys like in 2012, the party of free trade under Mitt Romney? Yes, we were. Weren't you guys the party since 1915 of standing strong against Russia?
But what's that? That means that has been what I think is one the most harmful thing in politics these days. That's because everything turned into culture war. There was no longer any, besides a few core issues like maybe abortion and a couple other things, there's almost no more political disagreement. There's culture war. There's, the libs are the worst and they're ruining the world and they're burning their cities and the ball, that garbage that just gets, as I said earlier, just projected into the minds of, my parents who are Fox News viewers forever. And so I don't know, I don't know that that was a meaningful shift on issues or anything. I think that was more, we're focused on, does our candidate piss off the right people? If so, then whatever they say is fine for the most part, within some constraints, but very narrow constraints.
But here's the thing, right? At the point in which you have gone all in on Red Map, right? On the Hofeller strategy, we are a white nationalist party in a country that demographically we are about to be in the permanent minority. At some point when you are, when that fails, right? When you can't shut out all immigration and, prevent trends such that like what you call white people are 45% or less of the national electorate, right? At some point then, as a party, you have to abandon that strategy, right? Like nobody says, my goal is to be, minority leader of the Senate for the rest of my life, right? Like, when you are minority leader of the Senate, you would like to be majority leader of the Senate and then president. And so the positive side, I think, again, this is a disaster, and I feel super naive for having not seen this in slow motion in action with redistricting in 2000. But at some point, like, you can't be a white nationalist in America and secure power without massively changing the structural rules that surround us now. So let's make sure they don't change those fucking rules. Right. Like, look, that's why that's really, really important. That's why if you still have somebody who's out there going like, well, I don't know, like Joe Biden doesn't inspire, like grab them and punch them. Right. Like this is seriously a fight for, are we going to let them change the rules to make this a white nation? And I would like to not do that. And I think if we hold that off, then the Republican Party will have no choice but to adapt. I could be wrong, but like, yeah. You know, I'm looking at the numbers and,
you know,
like,
I think, yeah. And
they're about to lose Texas, you know? Yeah.
We're out of time. I want to point out some very smart people in the chat were saying abortion is culture war. You know, yep. Maybe I have the wrong term there. Maybe I need a term that either doesn't exist or there is one and I don't know it, which is probably more likely. But I mean it in terms of it's about a fixation with the people within the opposing party are bad rather than what's an issue I believe something on. I take people at their word for the most part because I know a lot of these people. There are a lot of people who, for religious reasons, are against abortion. Now, we can unpack that a lot of that is – it's hard to see which the chicken and the egg with the controlling women versus whatever. It's hard to see, like, does the desire to control women's bodies lead the religion to give it, which is probably true. But anyway, I'll take people at their word that they genuinely believe that abortion is murder, and that's an issue that at least there's, like – a policy you can have, like you either have a policy of people get to do what the fuck they want with their bodies or not, versus what I think it is now. And maybe there's a better word for it. It's just all Fox News is a focus on demonizing the people contained within the other side rather than, and issues are part of that. You know, there's probably overlap, like, oh, they're getting abortions on demand and all that. Like, but like, that's kind of what I'm going for. And maybe culture war isn't quite the right term there or something, but I just wanted to look at that. I don't think it's wedge issue either. It's the opposite of issue. It's not about issues. It's about the all, like, do you, I know, I'm sure a lot of people in the audience have watched Fox News. Like, I can't be alone. It's merely about just focusing in on these people are bad. These people are bad. These people are bad. And so if you're thinking people are voting on like, oh, do I want a 28% top tax rate or 26% top? They're not, they're voting on, I saw there's a bunch of evil people who want to kill police officers, you know, like, so what is that called? Whatever that is.
Yeah.
It's not a wedge issue.
Abortion is
a wedge issue.
I have so many thoughts on this. I'm going to start with, it's astonishing to, I mean, like, I want to reinforce what you just said, which is we are now into the second consecutive presidential election in which there will not be issues, right? Like it is neither 2016 nor 2020 is about anything that you would define as a political issue, wedge or otherwise, right? Yeah. Like it's not. And the self-admitted vacuity of, you know, Trump saying, I know you've seen this clip on John Oliver of Trump saying like, yeah, I started saying drain the swamp because it got, you know, applause, but you know, and we all know that means nothing, right? Like it less than nothing, right? Like Trump is the swampiest president that there that could possibly, right? So I'm also thinking about something that polling organizations started doing, and it is informative and terrifying at the same time. But it's the thing that I've called the like shirts and skins mentality on the show. And, you know, and I know, right. I mean, I talk about, how terrible Donald Trump is, right? Like I get it pointed at me as well. But polling organizations have started testing questions like, the Democrats have a plan to put, you know, a man on the moon. The Republicans believe that the moon is a hollow,
made
you know,
out of cheese.
Yeah, is made out of cheese and does not orbit the Earth. Do you think the moon orbits the Earth? Right. And they're getting like 30% of people saying, no, obviously the moon does not orbit the Earth.
Right.
And look, those people are not honestly saying that, right? What they're saying is, I value my identity as supporting the Republican position such that I'm going to answer this question this way, regardless of the factual truth of the matter. And so whenever you see, by the way, look for that. Whenever you see like BuzzFeed, like crazy clickbait, like 36% of Americans think the sun is made out of tacos or whatever, right? Yeah. Like that's always why it is. Right.
Right.
But that's fucking terrifying. Right?
Like, yeah. You know, some people said identity politics. I think that's right. I think it is a white identity politics. I think that's a big part of it. But I think, I don't know. I think culture war is part of it, but maybe I'll try to refine my definition. Thanks, chat, for pushing back there. I'll have to try to, cause I talk about that a lot on my show, and I do want to make sure I'm using the right terms, but that really is, if you take a minute, you know, which it's hard to advise doing, but if you take a minute to watch Fox News, you see what it is. And anyone like, you know, if people in my family and people I hear are voting Republican, the reason is like, because these people are these horrible people, you know, like it never has. I want to vote Democrat because I want to value immigrants and let more refugees into this country. I want to tax the wealthy more. I want to give people health care. Like there's these issues are the reason that I'm going to vote for Joe Biden. Whereas when you ask a lot of people why they might be voting for Trump, it's because he pisses certain people off. And that's the totality of their reasoning.
Yeah.
It's terrible. But anyway, all right, we're over time. Thanks so much, everybody. That was a lot of fun. And as always, it's like my favorite thing. I wish more people joined us. I put it out the audio on the Patreon though, so people will catch it there. But thanks, everybody. That's it for me.
Thank
Andrew,
you.
Feel free to sign off. Yep. All right. See you, folks. Next
I
month.
I am Fred.